now at the beginning of an age of such renewal, at least aware of our great difficulties, and we may find the will to do something about them. So he is a sanguine man. It's bound up with his Quakerism in part, and indeed with the kind of Main Street background from which he comes. He's primarily a Main Street Quaker, use that expression. He thinks about, he asks the question, where does a president find support? But he has to make hard decisions. There are hard decisions. Where does any president find support? Not myself, but any president. When there's a hard and embarrassing decision to be made, where do you find support? He said, there isn't very much support nowadays for a hard decision. The people you expect to be with you are not with you. When there's something awkward to be decided, you don't find big business and behind you. They've gone into the woodwork somewhere when the hard decision has to be made. They aren't vocal in your support. You don't find it in the academy. He said, I know I have probably some friends in the academy, but they certainly aren't very conspicuous. Where do you get support? He said, I get it from Main Street. But Main Street is, as he knows, is diminishing in power, numbers. Where do we find the class that will support us? And yet the hope was still with him, the hope that by taking arms against a sea of troubles, we may overcome them. Well, I talked about Eliot on the prospects for the future. Eliot, of course, was not a hopeful man in terms of social prospects. But that led us into a discussion of class and how leadership is derived from class. And here I think it's worthwhile to digress a little and speak about Eliot. On Eliot on the question of class versus elite. Or to put it another way, perhaps poet versus intellectual. Now, Eliot was against the idea and the reality of an elite. I was taking this up once with the university president recently, who was who thought his own views were very like my own, and I spoke against an elite. He was very surprised. He said, you're against an elite? Who's in favor of it, if you weren't in favor of it? And I said, there's plenty of people who are in favor of it. They may proclaim themselves doctrinaire Democrats. As a matter of fact, they do desire an elite, and they themselves are to be the elite. But an elite is very different from a class. That's a distinction that Eliot makes in notes towards the definition of culture, particularly. A class is made up of people, of course, common background and common interests, and a class tends to perpetuate its culture from generation to generation by a kind of imperceptible merging of generations. It carries on a certain sense of duty, responsibility, and a belief in its own order. Against class, Eliot set the idea of the elite as advanced by Karl Mannheim. And the exchange between Eliot and Mannheim, they were acquainted, incidentally, would be very important indeed had it been carried on at greater length. Mannheim had died only shortly before this book was published. Eliot's book was published, so he didn't reply to it. But it would have been, had it been expanded, it would have been rather like the exchange between Bentham and Coleridge in the 19th century, with, of course, Mannheim in the role of Bentham and Eliot in the role of his mentor, Coleridge. Mannheim, of course, had been writing about the elite in the years just shortly before the publication of Notes towards the Definition of Culture, and Mannheim had maintained that we must develop elites to govern the future society. Eliot replied that these elites could not really maintain culture because they themselves, in essence, are uncultured in a general sense. They are collections of specialists. They are people without real roots, without a sense of continuity. They tend by the very nature of their training to be arrogant and to be fond of power, to neglect the duties that go with power. And he said, this elite of the future will be a will neither be neither cultured nor mild. With this, he contrasted class, which, of course, there are many levels of class. He's speaking just of one class. A class which carries on the cultural continuity and which takes a much broader view of society and which, in its essence, is a much more humane way of governing a society than is the recruiting by artificial measures of an elite. Here, incidentally, is one of the numerous points on which Eliot and Orwell agreed. Orwell wrote a very interesting review of Notes Towards the Definition of Culture, in some ways reinforcing Eliot and pointing out things that Eliot hadn't taken up. And Orwell, of course, in several of his books, speaks against the idea of an elite, and he speaks of this in 1984, the coming of this new elite composed of people from the arid worlds of bureaucracy and big business, and the naked generation of the public swimming baths, people like that, without roots, without a genuine moral consciousness, people intent upon power. They make up, of course, the governing class, or elite, rather, of 1984. Well, thus, Eliot took a stand against an elite and in favor of class, and Mr. Nixon and I talked about class, and how, indeed, culture is carried on by classes at various levels. Mr. Nixon was speaking of how people seem to have no understanding what life is about nowadays, true sense of moral responsibilities in society. And I said, well, yes, that's in part the result of a decay of class. And the attempt to thrust off educational responsibilities formally carried on within a class, within a family, upon formal schooling. Schooling can't really substitute for the kind of education which family and class gave. And I said, for example, my own background was in railroad yards outside Detroit, and my father was an engine driver, a locomotive engineer. But there was a culture within our own family, and indeed within our own class. And this sustained that order, that element of society. I was born in a kind of railroad ghetto. It had its own culture, its own class, very orderly. Worked out very well. Obviously, you can enter that class or you can leave it, but the class itself is a highly valuable thing. And Mr. Nixon's response was, well, yes, it was just that way with me. My father was a motorman, so he was. Street railways. And he understood that kind of class and family background very well. Cultural continuity and a sense of responsibility developed in family and class. That's what Eliot praises in the Notes Towards the Definition of Culture. But as we can contrast class with elite, so we may contrast the poet and the intellectual. At this point, I didn't have time really to get into with Mr. Nixon, but again, it's worth a digression. In various of my writings, I've made a contrast between the intellectual and the scholar. And we can make a very, very similar contrast between the intellectual and the poet. Mr. Nixon, of course, is neither an intellectual nor a poet. But he does understand, to some extent at least, the opposition of the intellectuals to a person like himself. And although he certainly has little knowledge of poetry or indeed of general of humane letters, still he shares the kind of understanding of life which we find in many of the great poets, because he's part of a tradition, even though he's not wholly conscious of the character of that tradition. Well, so it is that we live in a world in which we hear the intellectual cried up on all hands, without an understanding, really, of the danger in the concept of the intellectual as a noun of persons. I want to try here to go through the whole history of the word, but it was, in general, a term of denigration in England, well, right on down to the present, and was a term of denigration in America until at least very recent years. And denigration not upon simply upon the basis of particular political views. Thus, we find Bertrand Russell being asked a few years ago by a correspondent, about 10 years before he died. Bertrand Russell was asked to define this word intellectual, and he replied, "No one has ever called me an intellectual in my presence, and I hope that no one will ever dare to do so. I think an intellectual is a person who pretends to know more than he does know, and I hope that description does not fit myself." Thus, presumption, the idea of presumption lies within the concept of the intellectual. Again, the intellectual is really a rationalist with a capital R. a topic, of course, touched upon by the preceding speaker. The presumption of intellectuality as detached, separated from moral worth and from tradition. The intellectual is a kind of person, of course, whom Michael Oakeshott criticizes in his Rationalism and Politics. Mannheim, however, had, of course, little fear of the intellectual. He substantially wanted a world governed by specialized intellectuals. But Eliot took a very different stand, and Eliot pointed out that modern intellectuals, and particularly 20th century political theorists, a great many of them, do mischief. Eliot wrote, being occupied with humanity only in the mass, it, that is, modern political theory, tends to separate itself from ethics. Being occupied only with that recent period of history during which humanity can be most easily be shown to have been ruled by impersonal forces, it, that is, modern political science or theory, reduces the proper study of mankind to the last 200 or 300 years of man. It too often inculcates a belief in a future inflexibly determined, and at the same time a future which we are wholly free to shape as we like. Again, the vice of presumption. Well, thus Eliot is against both the intellectual in the sense of defecated rationality and against the kind of political theory which he found in Mannheim, which reduces man. Makes him much smaller than he is, and which in the long run, Eliot says, becomes enslaving. And is enslaved, first of all, and spiritually, and then enslaved, perhaps, politically, in the social order. Thus it is that Mr. Nixon has an instinct to keep away from the intellectual. He doesn't want the kind of person who is a court intellectual at the courts of King Johnson or King Kennedy. Nevertheless, he is rather puzzled at his lack of support in the Academy. He feels, here I am standing for American political tradition, for moral heritage, and why are there so few voices raised? We took up that question to some degree, and it led us into certain considerations relating to modern formal education. Point on which Mr. Nixon is somewhat naive, as all presidents are somewhat naive, or frankly all of them. That is, Mr. Nixon, like all people who've been a long time out of university and college, and who are now in high post, but have been, by their active careers, more or less cut off from university and college, thinks of these institutions, especially of higher education, as being still like those that he knew in his youth. And so he tends to think of an undergraduate college as being very like Whittier College in California, Quaker College, a few hundred students, a pleasant little town in those days. He's surprised that he doesn't get the same response from colleges that he would have gotten in his own day in college. And he thinks of a university as being rather like Duke University Law School with 50 or 75 students out in the middle of the Piney Woods when he was there. And he's surprised still. That's a very different attitude, he finds, in many quarters, including, of course, and perhaps conspicuously, professors of law, the kind of professors he knew. Well, he was surprised that I said, well, the educational structure has gone wrong, and it's one of the big troubles is the inhumane scale. This causes great resentments, a feeling of lostness among students, and indeed among professors. Is that really true? The idea was novel to him, that the scale itself did mischief and caused the attitude attitudes we've been talking about. It's one of the causes. Because he tends to think of, still, I think, in terms of quantitative growth. He does very strongly oppose the National Education Association and their bricks and mortar and more substitute policy, but still he thinks in terms of quantitative growth. And of course, he backs and fills on it. He has hesitations from time to time. Another speech will be in favor of more quantitative growth. And still tends to think, as most Americans think, that only if we got everybody in college and got them all degrees of some kind or other, how happy they'd be and how much better off we'd all be. Again, he hesitates on that. He was surprised that I took a firm stand against this. and would say definitely that the thing is wrong and that a great many people shouldn't be there and are only miserable when they are there, and to put in some figures and examples and so on. But he does recognize that there is something wrong with the intellectual climate of opinion and is glad to have reasons or some explanation given of the situation in which we find ourselves. Well, let me turn, however, from that idea of the poet versus intellectual and the class versus elite to the, or at least to another aspect of it, to the idea of a poet as a man who has something to say about the social order. The great poets, of course, have been earnestly concerned about the social order, and particularly the order of poets, of which the succession of poets of which Eliot found himself to be a representative. That is, his great exemplars were Virgil and Dante and Dryden, Coleridge, all of whom were passionately concerned. Well, Plato, of course, if you go back earlier. All passionately concerned with questions of the social order, and of course as related to the moral order. And I suppose the poet to whom Eliot was closest of all in sympathy, Virgil, or rather Dante. Dante, of course, conspicuously is a man of politics, theoretical politics at least, as well as a man of poetic imagery and of the moral imagination. Thus, the poet, great poet, is concerned with these questions and has a great deal to say, although his words usually go, for the time being, unheeded. He may have a very large influence, indeed, on the shape of society in a subtle sort of way over the centuries, but not ordinarily by any practical consequences in his own time, even though he hopes so. Virgil had more influence, I suppose, than most, since he was, after all, close to the man, the most powerful man in the world, the emperor or the Augustus, princeps. Dante, of course, was not so close, was not close to any great seat of power. Nevertheless, Dante, of course, entertained this high hope that in his own time, the medieval order might be reinvigorated and renewed and purged by a common effort of the empire, that is, of the political state, of the church, as represented by the papacy, and of the universities. He treated these three as sort of equal powers. And he hoped that the new Emperor Henry, coming down from the Germanies and making a triumphal progress through Italy, was his man. Here's a man who'll understand me. Here's someone who can get these three working together, one person who can restore order, and order on a moral basis. Well, he was disappointed. Henry did not have the diplomatic skills or even the military power that Dante had expected. He failed to conciliate or to overawe the papacy or of the great princes and states of Germany, and in mid-career he died of disease in Italy. And Dante's practical hope was over. Nevertheless, of course, in the long run, Dante's influence, in a subtle sort of way, on our understanding of social order, is very great. And despite Eliot's lack of hope for the social order in which he found himself, in fact, his lack of even regret for it, still it may be that his influence in the long run will be much larger than he expected. A poet like that does have power over the centuries, if he is a great poet and endures. Eliot is, of course, always looking at the decay of modern civilization and culture with the poet's eye, with the poet's insights. And here, maybe permitted another brief digression, which is related to our previous speaker's remarks. The question of this power of perception of the heart, in Pascal's usage, the perception of which, what, and of course, Eliot often quoted Pascal on that particular point, as did Dostoevsky. What Eliot called the sentiments. Sentiments derived from the heart, as opposed to pure rationality or pure reason in the Enlightenment sense. Eliot had that kind of curious power of insight, which cannot be accounted for by pure reason. And there's a remark in the book by Andre Malraux, I believe. No, someone else. Anyway, a recent series of essays, which he touches upon this power of poetic insight and indeed of scientific insight. This kind of perception, which has not come from scientific experiment, testing and measuring, but from some other source. In this instance, the poet, St. John Peirce, whose principal work Eliot translated and published, St. John Peirce had gotten a Nobel Prize and had come to America to receive some honorary degree at Columbia, I believe. The newspaper account of his coming was noticed by Albert Einstein, then at Princeton, and so Einstein sent a note to St. John Peirce asking if he'd come to talk with him about a problem. And so St. John Peirce came down to Princeton, and Einstein said, there's something I've been wanting to ask a person like yourself. I understand that you certainly are a famous poet, and I understand from what I've read that you're a very good one and are so recognized by those who know something about poetry. I myself know very little about poetry, but I have read yours, and so far as I'm able to appreciate such things, it seems very good to me. I wanted you to ask you this question. These poetic images that come to you, these insights into the character of man, how do you arrive at them? Clearly, to judge by the critics of your poetry, you have certain insights that few others have, and indeed very few poets have. How do these things come to you? What is it, by a rational process, by observation of people? How do you get these concepts? And St. John Peirce said, well, I can't really account for it. It's a different sort of perception. It comes to me ordinarily in images. And suddenly an impression is born in strongly upon me, and an image. And then I try to test the validity of that image by what rational powers I have, and to see whether it's true or false. And sometimes I conclude it's false, but after examining it, sometimes I decide it's true. Then it goes into my poetry. And Einstein said, yes, I understand exactly. That's exactly the way I work. I have certain insights, intuitions, you want to call them that. Things are born in upon me, so from a source from without. And then I test them by scientific means at my disposal, and so far as those means will allow, I determine whether they're true or false. But the original impression does not come from the testing process. The testing process is to check it. It is a different source of perception, which accounts for what people consider my important ideas. Well, that's what we're talking about with the poet's armed vision. And Eliot is able to apply that vision in part to certain of the concerns of society, and so is worth being noticed by men of statecraft. Here in 20th century America, we find the poet and intellectual really opposed. The intellectual has an appetite for power. And in our own time, often he rejoices in disorder. His assumption is somehow, apparently, that out of disorder will come a new rule, which will be the rule of an elite, an intellectual elite. Somehow, upon that great wave of revolution, he will be born to the situation which he so richly deserves by his powerful rationality. The poet usually looks at things very, very differently. And like T.S. Eliot, or like Robert Frost in this country, there's a great deal more humility in him, a great deal better understanding of the complexity of human affairs, and indeed of the dangers of power and of defecated rationality. He fears the captive mind of ideology, and he fears indeed capture by an arrogant, defecated rationality itself. The poet is concerned not for power, but for the permanent things, that make up order and justice and freedom, and for the permanent things in the human condition. And Eliot saw all around him the permanent things, at least in the form of visible institutions or social institutions, going to pieces. He wrote in one of his few rather picturesque passages in the notes towards the definition of culture, he wrote as follows: we are destroying our ancient edifices to make ready the ground upon which the barbarian nomads of the future would encamp in their mechanized caravans. Mr. Nixon still, of course, hopes the mechanized caravans may be delayed coming. There's a poet in Chicago right now. It is an English poet who's visiting here. When I talked yesterday, a Paul Rush, who was strongly influenced by Eliot, although critical of Eliot in some other ways. And Paul Rush has written a very good poem, a long poem called Death in Fun City. He didn't know at the time that New York was called Fun City, but it fits very well. And Paul Rush recently wrote a little piece in which he said that there should be a poet attached to every cabinet minister. He's an Englishman. A poet to every cabinet minister. That they save the ministers from a great deal of trouble. Ministers, he says, have in general no imagination, and they don't foresee the consequences of the policies which they commence. So he says, see what's happening to the face of Britain, with this inordinate building of massive highways, destruction of old towns, ruination of the countryside, destruction indeed of the system of railroad transport by all this. No imagination as to the consequences, what's going to happen. It's not just a matter of pouring the concrete. Things happen to people, things happen to communities. And he said, now, if only the Minister of Transport had to accept a poet, and he had listened to him, isn't what he said, and every other cabinet minister too, and indeed we might have a considerably more decent society, which would be something better than Fun City. That indeed was Eliot's point, which he made in his lecture on the literature of politics in 1955. Eliot knew that the man of action and the man of thought are not the same person, that they ought to mingle, they ought to know each other, they ought to interact. The poet ought not to be the statesman, the statesman ought not to be the poet, they ought to know each other, to mingle in a kind of class of leaders of society, if you will, with mutual benefit. As I pointed out to Mr. Nixon, one reason why we have the alienation of the intellectual is that he feels himself, rightly or wrongly, left out of the public concerns, and he doesn't, although he has develops in part from this a revolutionary attitude. He desires power from himself, not understanding power, and indeed being divorced in a way by his own very training from reality. So I conclude with just three brief remarks. Eliot's poem, Coryland, his only political poem, is a poem about a master of a state who lacks moral sanction and moral imagination. He's come to power by bayonets. He's a strong man and probably a good man, but he hasn't any imagination and he has no moral sanction behind his rule. And so he finds himself desperate and under the thrust of all kinds of pressure groups at the end. His military strength will not solve this. And he says, Coryland cries out, cry, cry, what shall I cry? Doesn't know where to turn. He hasn't that moral sanction behind authority. He's in the situation, of course, in which even Napoleon found himself. And as Talleyrand remarked of Napoleon's regime, you can do everything with bayonets except sit upon them. Everything with bayonets except sit upon them. It is indeed the sanction of a moral authority, which is needed in any state. It is a moral imagination of the poetic kind, which enables a society to understand itself as something more than a mere machine for production and consumption. And in our time, we cannot too often, I think, reread William Butler Yeats's poem, The Leaders of the Crowd. You'll recall that Yeats says, speaking of the leaders of the crowd, the demagogues, the men, in fact, who ordinarily win office. He says, they have loud music, hope every day renewed, and heartier loves. That lamp is from the tomb. The lamp to which he refers is the lamp of the scholar, which is also in Yeats's case, in Eliot's case, the lamp of the poet. And after all, it is that lamp from the tomb, by which we perceive order in society.